Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It took them a while, but the House started debating new rules for Wall Street today. We'll look at what may or may not get done. Also, what's happening in Copenhagen? I mean, away from all that climate policy stuff. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America. 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 10th of December, and if you look back over your calendar, that makes it about a week shy of 15 months since Lehman Brothers left us, and since we crashed headlong into the financial crisis that we are just now working ourselves out of. There's been a lot of talk about how the rules needed to change on Wall Street, how we have to make sure nothing like what we have been through could ever happen again. So, how are we doing on that? Well, a bill has been drafted in the Senate. There has been one committee vote in the House of Representatives. Today, though, the full House did begin its debate, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
With big debates brewing over health care, jobs, and war, you'd be forgiven for letting something as wonky as financial regulation slide off your radar screen. Even Karen Seely, who works in finance, told us she's not paying much attention.
I don't really know, exactly what they're doing. I just know, bits and pieces of what they're doing, but not a whole lot about it.
Well, here's the abbreviated version. The House bill would finally regulate derivatives, which played a big part in bringing the financial system to its knees. It would start a new agency to look out for the consumer. It would set up a council to watch over companies that can pose a risk to the entire economy. And it would create a $150 billion fund in case a firm fails. Many here on Wall Street oppose the bill, and so do Republicans, like Congressman Pete Sessions of Texas.
My Democrat colleagues are using the policy and regulation to force a government takeover of the free enterprise system.
Sessions argued the regulatory bill will add to the deficit. That prompted this retort from Congressman John Dingell, a Democrat from Michigan.
Yes, we're having to spend money, and we're having to spend money because of mismanagement and because of outright rascality up in New York.
Many economists argue Congress had better act fast. Thomas Cooley is the dean of NYU's Stern School of Business. He says the financial crisis will slip from our collective memory as the economy improves.
And if we don't do something about sources of systemic risk in the system, then all we're doing is setting the table for the next financial crisis.
The House is expected to vote on the bill tomorrow. The Senate won't take up the issue until next year. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
No mention of the financial industry today would be complete without the following two items. The last big Wall Street bank still holding on to its bailout money is now apparently in negotiations with the government to pay back the $45 billion it got from TARP last year. That would be Citigroup. No real details to give you on when anything might actually happen on that. Also, Goldman Sachs. CEO Lloyd Blankfein and his colleagues have clearly heard the hue and cry over its multi-billion dollar compensation plans. Goldman announced today its 30 highest-ranking executives are going to get stock only for their bonuses this year. No cash for them at all. The Goldman gang is probably more a BlackBerry crowd than it is an iPhone crowd, but still, the iPhone has been a smashing success, except for the actual phone part. Customers, especially in densely packed cities like San Francisco and New York, routinely have their calls dropped and data connections disrupted. AT&T, the only carrier you can get an iPhone with, as a plan for that, you could call it the pretty please approach to customer service. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith explains.
There are roughly 10 million iPhone users in the U.S., and if you've ever spent any time with one, you know they're on their phone. A lot. Texting, answering calls, showing off the new Koi Pond app, and AT&T is making it all happen. Renee Ritchie is editor of the iPhone blog.
You have almost a full web browser, and people are starting to really use data. And that's hitting these networks very, very hard, right at the cell tower level. That tower basically gives up, can't handle it, and kind of melts into a little pathetic puddle in the corner somewhere.
In the name of pathetic puddle prevention, AT&T is building up its network and asking customers to cut back on things like video streaming. It's also considering charging iPhone users based on how much broadband they use, like they do with phone minutes. Broadband consultant Scott Cleland says carriers are going to have to start charging because the problem is only going to get bigger.
This is going to be a constant dilemma. The more customers you have, the more usage they want to use, puts more stress on a network.
But iPhone Blog's Renee Ritchie says even that probably won't solve AT&T's problem. iPhones make up about a third of the smartphone market, and even if customers cut back, it won't be enough. AT&T will probably have to give up its exclusive hold on the iPhone.
To have that many phones on one network, unless that network spends billions and billions of dollars, it's going to be a problem.
A new iPhone is set to be released this summer. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Down in Texas this past week, there have been two big industrial accidents, explosions at a chemical plant and an oil refinery. Those kinds of things are usually gone over with a fairly fine-tooth comb by the federal government. But the board that's in charge of investigating factory accidents isn't looking into either one of them. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains why.
Ever heard of the U.S. Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board? I didn't think so. It's modeled after the National Transportation Safety Board, but with a much smaller budget. It's in charge of investigating accidents at refineries and factories, with a budget of about $10 million, and a staff of 40.
If we got more money, we could investigate more accidents.
John Breslin chairs the Chemical Safety Board. He says it only investigates about 15% of the serious accidents in the U.S. every year. It's only required to investigate if a member of the public is killed. Breslin says that happened earlier this week near a manufacturing plant outside Chicago.
Something was blown out of the facility into the parking area of a rest stop on Interstate 90 and struck someone.
Jim Frederick is a health and safety expert with the United Steelworkers Union. He says there'll be more factory accidents because companies are taking safety shortcuts in this tough economy.
An 8-hour refresher training that's supposed to be done annually isn't performed. Rather, they get an hour or two here and there on a computer-based training module.
Congressman Gene Green is a Democrat from Houston, home of numerous refineries and chemical plants. He wants Congress to appropriate several million dollars for a chemical safety board office in Houston.
Because we don't want to lose one person or have one person injured.
Green says the Occupational Safety and Health Administration will investigate the two recent accidents in Texas, but OSHA is more focused on how companies comply with government regulations. It doesn't investigate what causes accidents. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nothing explosive. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are some truisms about the goings-on in Copenhagen, Denmark this week and next that might be helpful if you're interested in a fuller understanding of the UN climate conference. One is that it's dark and it's cold, about 7 hours of daylight today, temperatures in the low 40s with rain as well. Another truism is that there is way more going on than just a bunch of official delegates sitting around talking climate policy. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is at the conference for us. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So what is it like there?
It is the most bizarre and bewildering event that I've ever had to cover, Kai. I mean, first of all, one of the negotiating teams was quoted as saying at the outset, we've got 2 weeks to save the planet. Hmm. Well, I have to tell you, saving the planet is not as exciting as it seems. This is what it sounds like.
The UNFCCC parties had already decided to invite Annex 1 parties to the Kyoto Protocol to provide funding which will be additional to the shares of proceeds.
Wake me when that one's over, huh, Stephen?
It's not quite the way Hollywood would cover the saving of the planet. But it's not as boring as it sounds because we're in this huge conference centre and at the heart of it is a big conference hall, absolutely gigantic, like an aircraft hangar. And in this vast communal space, you've got all the negotiators and the journalists and the delegates and the environmental activists all mingling. And this area is actually constantly erupting in spontaneous demonstrations, with protesters chanting some of the oddest slogans I've ever heard.
We want 1 degree! We want 1 degree!
We want 1 degree, right? Is that what that was?
We want 1 degree, that's it. What they're saying is we want a ceiling of 1 degree. We don't want to see global average temperatures rise more than 1 degree by the end of the century. Something even odder, actually, when we arrived at the summit centre this morning, another bunch of people shivering in their underpants outside the summit, shouting, "We're in the cold to stop the heat."
So far, Stephen, I will tell you, it sounds not unlike a carnival.
Or even a madhouse. But in fact, what one should say is there is an enormous amount of idealism here. A lot of young people, 500 American kids, in fact, who are here to press the case for a new climate treaty. One of them, Ethan Buckner, is a 19-year-old student from Minnesota.
I feel charged and motivated and empowered and impassioned to try to really push the U.S. negotiators to understand our ecological debt, to understand how much we owe to the world.
Well, if that's the idealism, Stephen, surely there are skeptics there as well. I mean, it's an equal opportunity conference, I imagine.
Oh, it certainly is, although I should say the overwhelming majority here are rooting for a new climate treaty. But I did find one climate change skeptic, a British peer, Lord Monckton, who, as a skeptic, felt he was rather in enemy territory.
I have been surrounded by chanting children with zombie-like faces who have been trained by their teachers to yell fatuous slogans.
Such as?
And such as, "Ooh, ooh, it's hot in here. There's too much carbon in the atmosphere."
All right. Well, Stephen, so where do we go from here? Once you get past it all, there is serious work being done, yes?
Yes, behind closed doors, they are negotiating hard, and the signs are that something serious is emerging. And what is certainly really focusing minds here now is that next week the leaders arrive. More than 100 heads of state will be here, including President Obama, and that has convinced many that in spite of all the circus and the carnival, something meaningful, something serious will emerge from Copenhagen.
Stephen Beard in the Danish capital with a slice of life, if you will. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
There's an old vaudeville joke that goes a little something like this. How do you dance with an elephant? The answer, of course, is very carefully, which is the way the island of Taiwan is approaching its relationship with China. Officials from both sides met today to set up a new round of trade talks, a very big deal after 60 years of mutual animosity. But the government on Taiwan is taking this whole detente thing one elephant step at a time. From Taipei, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
At a roadside snack stand in Taiwan, I pick up a favorite local dish, a fried fish cake lathered in sauce. It's called Sweet Not Spicy, and that just about captures Taiwan's nervous hopes for its new economic deal with mainland China. After 6 decades of Cold War chill, the two sides are cozying up, and Taiwan's opening its doors to China Inc. First in, coachloads of mainland tourists. They started coming last year. And today, bus after bus winds through Taroko Gorge, Taiwan's answer to the Grand Canyon. So what do the Chinese think of this new detente? Mainland passenger Jingping.
I knew there'd be beautiful scenery and enchanting weather, but my regret is the trip's been so rushed I haven't eaten some of the signature food from Taiwan.
Mr. Jing plays a good ambassador. He's generous with the compliments and souvenir purchases. But somehow, Taiwanese cabbie Wang Xiutao forgot to play her role of gracious host.
Mainlanders love buffet, but they rush in line and take too much food. Other tourists look and shake their heads. The Chinese lack manners. If they're going to go out into the world, they need to fix that.
She'd better get used to it. Ready or not, here they come. Chinese tourists, airlines, investors. And a sweeping trade deal next year could bring over mainland students and property developers. Until now, the whole relationship had been one way. Taiwan going to China. Big time. Taiwanese singer Jay Zhou is by far the mainland's biggest pop star. Taiwan brands dominate China's bottled tea market and instant noodles, not to mention Taiwan-owned factories in China. Taiwan manufacturer Foxconn assembled your iPhone and probably your laptop. Last year, Foxconn earned $62 billion. That's more than Boeing or Microsoft or Pfizer. Taiwan does well in China. But as the door opens the other way, there's debate whether it's good for Taiwan.
There's no way economically you want to turn your back.
On one side, Philip Chow at the Taiwan Tourism Bureau.
Truly, it's a global village. We share the same cultural background, language. We have to make our most of this situation.
The situation could create 200,000 jobs under a new trade deal with China. That's according to supporters. But Taiwan's former defense minister, Chung Pin Lin, smells an economic Trojan horse. This worries him, even as he drives to an evening dinner in downtown Taipei.
We hear the fear of being bought. Beijing has finally learned the key to unification. It is cheaper and easier to buy Taiwan than to attack Taiwan.
Lin fears Chinese investors could seize control of Taiwanese media and start muting criticism of the mainland. He thinks Beijing is trying to sell this message.
The future of Mecca of the world is Beijing. Come and worship.
Skeptics also fear Beijing investors could control listed companies in Taiwan, and therefore the stock market. Whether any of that's true, the economic fact is Taiwan's GDP is a puny one-tenth of China's. So it needs to dance carefully, says local economist Chen Liying.
If the China banks come too quick, our small, medium-sized banks will be squeezed out of the market. If we open too big, it's like flooding.
This week, Taiwan's prime minister vowed to protect any Taiwan banks from being acquired by Chinese banks. On the streets of Taipei, there's a realization that a go-slow approach could mean any peace dividend will come slowly. Like many countries, this island is trying to strike a balance with emerging China. Opportunity and risk, trust but verify. Sweet and hopefully not spicy. In Taipei, Taiwan, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, a Rust Belt town goes gourmet. It's pretty cheap, too.
Duck confit, pork belly, two different kinds of sausages, and some great white beans for $14. I cannot beat that.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 68 points today, 0.2%, finished at 10,405. The NASDAQ added 7 points, 0.3%, closed at 2190. The S&P 500 up 6 points, 0.5%, ended things at 1102. It's game on for Coca-Cola as Costco allowed its soft drinks back onto store shelves after a battle over pricing. Coke popped up 1.3%. Costco rose a 0.1%. Gannett continued its two-day rally based on better-than-expected earnings and increased ad sales. The publisher of USA Today rolled off a 7% gain. Drugmaker Eli Lilly drained off 4.2% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America. 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. By Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms helping business owners and in-house counsel find pre-qualified local legal counsel for over 19 years. Meritas.org. And by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. Our icon on your iPhone. The Marketplace app gives you the latest in business news, plus the Marketplace whiteboards and the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday.
In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for November. A House subcommittee on commercial and administrative law holds a hearing on foreclosures. At discussion, will voluntary mortgage modification help families save their homes? And 1 year ago, on December 11th, 2008, Bernie Madoff was arrested on fraud charges. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Conventional wisdom in the world of brand management is that more is better. The more widely known and more widely available your product is, the more money you're going to make. With that theory firmly in mind, the maker of Peeps, those little marshmallow chicks and bunnies, they opened their first store near Washington, D.C. today. So we sent Sabri Benashour to take a peep.
It takes just a quick search on YouTube to see how seriously people take their Peeps.
There's Lord of the Peeps. There's Star Wars and Peeps.
Kathy Basininski is vice president of brand development for Just Born, Peeps' parent company.
It's a cultural phenomena. We know a third of the Peeps that people buy aren't eaten.
There are science experiments on Peeps and campaigns to stop science experiments on Peeps. And now, behold, there is a Peeps store. Karen Simonet mans the register.
We have stuffed Peeps. We have the chocolate-covered Peeps. We have our Peep water bottles that say, chillin' with my Peeps. We also have hand-blown glass crystal Peeps.
There are 850 different Peeps products here. Retail analyst Owen Shapiro says the store has potential.
There's a number of different brands that have used sort of destination stores and flagship stores as part of their marketing campaign.
Apple or Disney, for example. Shapiro says a store doesn't have to make a lot of money to be helpful to the brand. But it's not just any company that can pull it off.
You know, you have to be a pretty powerful brand. Typically, they're high emotion brands.
High emotion doesn't seem to be a problem here. Phaedra Milton is another manager who was here for the soft opening last month.
We had to have police officers that just came and started directing people. We had so many.
If the store is successful, the company says more stores will pop up around the country. In Oxon Hill, Maryland, I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
Here's one of those recession-related conundrums that makes covering the economy so interesting. At the same time that many Americans are eating in more, or if they do go out, it's straight to the McDonald's dollar menu, there are an amazing number of high-end restaurants opening and succeeding, a lot of them in places that have been clobbered by a falling economy, places like Cleveland, Ohio. Dan Bobkoff of WCPN has more.
I didn't expect much from Cleveland's restaurants when I moved here 3 years ago. I had an East Coast snob's opinion of Midwestern cooking. Boy, was I wrong.
What are you thinking of ordering?
I could order anything on this menu and be happy.
I met lunch with food writer and Cleveland food booster Michael Ruhlman. We're sitting in a new restaurant called Laubitro. It's an old carriage house with bold artwork on the brick walls. Our waiter comes over to help us decipher the appetizer.
It's a braised tongue and oxtail terrine with pickled mustard seeds. Next to it is kind of a roulade of sorts, of pork with dried figs.
I think there was some rabbit in there, too. Foodies, take note. Here in the Rust Belt, you can now get a world-class meal for about what you'd pay at an Olive Garden.
Can you believe that? Duck confit, pork belly, two different kinds of sausages, and some great white beans for $14. You cannot beat that.
This restaurant opened up just last year at the height of the financial crisis. Yet owner and chef Zach Brule says Laubitro is thriving. Cleveland's low cost of living means those with jobs can generally afford some nice meals. And he says there's a demand now for interesting food.
The sophistication level has changed dramatically in the last 25 years. I mean, if I would never have thought of doing this concept 25 years ago.
In the next few weeks, Brule will open his fourth new restaurant in 5 years. And he has competition like never before. From chefs like Dante Bucuzzi, who's putting the finishing touches on two new restaurants in Cleveland's up-and-coming Tremont neighborhood. It's gentrification just blocks from once bustling steel mills.
Soft benches, nice coffee tables.
Bucuzzi made his name in big cities like New York, where the pace is fast and failure is common. Cleveland's cheap rent and lower startup costs make opening here a less risky bet.
The
Everything about it is a lot less. And I think that was one of the main draws that brought me back to Cleveland. Just the whole market itself. I mean, there's a lot of great restaurants, but it's not like there's 3,000 of them like New York City.
But 20 years ago, chefs like Boccuzzi likely wouldn't have had much luck in smaller cities. What changed? Americans got a lot more food savvy. They started to ask what's in their meals and where the ingredients came from. Organic and local food entered the lexicon. Enrollment went way up at U.S. culinary schools. And let's not forget the rise of the Food Network.
The next Iron Chef is... Chef Simon!
Michael Simon, Cleveland's hottest chef, put his city on the culinary map when he won the Food Network's Iron Chef competition 2 years ago.
He was definitely... has become the poster child for Cleveland, and every city needs a poster child.
Andrew Knowlton is the restaurant editor for Bon Appetit magazine. He and Cleveland food writer Michael Ruhlman were both judges on that show. Knowlton says the burgeoning foodie scene in Cleveland is a microcosm for what's happening nationwide, and that the availability of great ingredients from local farms gives the Midwest an edge.
You know, the food revolution is going to happen in the flyover states. It's not about New York and San Francisco.
Then, maybe I'm not a snob. Good food is now mainstream. So, in Cleveland, where the food's great, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note this afternoon, the newspaper industry has lost its own newspaper. The Nielsen Company announced today that it is shutting down the journalism trade paper editor and publisher. It's part of a larger deal that Nielsen's doing with the private equity group. It's selling off the Hollywood Reporter and Billboard magazine, among others, to a group run, interestingly enough, by Alan Schwartz, who, as it happens, was the last CEO of Bear Stearns. Anyway, editor and publisher had been around for more than 100 years. In this digital age, though, the shutdown of its print publication and its website are effective right about now. And right about now, that's time for us to go. It's Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow bumped up 68 points, 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, 1/3%. The S&P 500 took on 6 points. That's about 0.5%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Get the latest from our crew in Copenhagen first thing tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. And next time on this program, figuring out how to pay for climate change isn't all that easy.
Our imagination is always lacking in the beginning when we stand in front of a huge mountain. If you climb it and you go up one by one, then you will see, oh, I'm going to reach the top. It's not so difficult.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.